be followed for new buildings to be eligible for compensation. The collapsing towns were rebuilt in the old Tudor style, with each new house resting on a timber frame that had built-in anchors for the placement of hydraulic jacks powerful enough to lift sinking buildings. An 18-inch lift looking like a canister was capable of hoisting 50 tons. It was the same technology that had been used to lift salt barges at the Anderton Boat Lift. England is sometimes thought of as a land of eccentrics who stubbornly cling to quaint and hopelessly outmoded ways. But it is also the land of entrepreneurs who created the Industrial Age. British industrialists built powerful companies, such as the Salt Union, that were the forerunners of today's multinational giants. In Cheshire, these two kinds of Englishmen were represented by the Thompsons and the Stubbses. Both families have long histories in Cheshire salt. A 1710 map marks John Stubbs' salt pit, though today's Stubbses do not know exactly who John was. Some Stubbses were dreamers. It was the Cheshire Stubbs who built a plantation in the Turks and Caicos Islands. But in the 19th century, the Stubbses joined the Industrial Age and sent their sons to school to study engineering. The Thompsons were cursed with longevity. So while the Stubbses' family operations were run by well-educated young engineers schooled in new technologies, the Thompsons' family salt business was often run by octogenarian grandfathers and great-grandfathers. Both families had salt works near the sinking town of Northwich. Eventually, various members of the Stubbs family had salt works all over Cheshire. But toward the end of the century, brine works, unable to compete with large companies, were one by one going broke, sinking either financially or literally. In the 1870s, various Stubbs brothers consolidated their operations, and in 1888, they sold out to the Salt Union. After selling out and taking a seat on the board of directors, some of the brothers opened new salt works across the county line. Then, in 1923, they bought the new Cheshire Salt Works near Northwich. The Thompsons were not that different. In 1856, they started the Alliance Salt Works by digging a hole behind the Red Lion Hotel. But they too wanted to remain an independent family operation, and after they sold the Alliance Salt Works to the Salt Union in 1888, they dug a new shaft beside the Red Lion Hotel and called it the Lion Salt Works. New technology had concentrated on finding salt and bringing it to the surface. But once the brine reached the salt works, little had changed since the time of the Romans. It was still evaporated in lead pans. The pans had gotten larger than the 3-by-3-foot Roman ones. The Thompsons had 30-by-20-foot lead pans, heated by coal that was stoked from 4 furnace doors in the huge coal oven under the pan. Into the 19th century, even the pipes for brine were still made from hollowed tree trunks. Except for larger pans and coal being burned instead of wood, most of the process was described in Georges Agricola's 1556 work, De Re Metallica, which remained the standard European text on salt making. The work was first translated into English in 1912 by mining engineer and future U.S. President Herbert Hoover and his wife, Lou Henry Hoover. Cheshire salt makers had become skilled at making different products for an expanding and varied list of customers. Most of this simply involved adjusting the cooking time. Dairy salt was cooked fast, so that the rapidly moving water would create fine crystals used in butter and cheese. The large grains of solar-heated sea salt were replicated with the slow heating of so-called 14-day salt, which was shipped to Grimsby for salting cod. Salt hardened into blocks and then crushed was locally called Lagos salt, because it was shipped to West Africa. Because the West African market bought salt by volume rather than by weight, all the Cheshire companies made a large, lightweight crystal for that market. But in 1905, James Stubbs went to Michigan to learn about a new evaporator. The fundamental concept of a vacuum evaporator is that lower pressure reduces the boiling point of a liquid. A boiler produces steam, which heats a chamber, an evaporator. The steam is then piped into a second evaporator. The second evaporator cannot heat to as high a temperature, but because it is in a vacuum, the pressure is lower and less heat is needed for steam. This steam can then be passed to a third evaporator. And so an entire series of evaporators can be operated on the fuel that was expended to heat the first one. This solves one of the oldest problems in salt brine production, the problem the ancient Chinese solved with gas, the cost of fuel. Liverpool sugar refiners had been using steam evaporators since 1823, when William Fernicle had introduced the use of steam heat in sugar refining. In 1887, the first vacuum pan salt process was put in operation by Joseph Duncan in Silver Springs, New York. The evaporator heated brine to steam and forced it into a tank, where salt crystals formed. Once the crystals reached a certain size and weight, they dropped through the bottom. If they were too big, they would be washed back up by the incoming brine. If too small, they would not drop down. For the first time in the long history of salt, a salt was being made in which every crystal was the same size. The steam from the first tank was used to heat a second tank and a third tank. Today, up to 6 or even 8 tanks, each evaporating brine, can be fueled by the first evaporating tank. In the 1930s, the Stubbses finally imported the first salt evaporator to England, to their new Cheshire Salt Works. This magnificent triple-towered machine was Art Deco in design, with vertical stripes of dark and blonde wood and polished brass fittings and gauges. For a while, the Stubbses still had some open pans for larger crystal salt, but in time the old pans could no longer compete economically with modern evaporators. New, more efficient evaporators were bought in the 1950s and again in the 1990s. The Stubbses, along with the Salt Union, are among only 3 surviving commercial British salt producers. Anyone who makes bread in any quantity finds himself getting through a great deal of salt. What salt, then, to use? Since, with the exception of the famous Maldon salt from Essex on the East Coast, again a luxury, there is now no sea salt extracted from English or Scottish waters, I use Cheshire rock salt, sold in 1.5-pound blocks, or 2-pound bags, or 6-pound clear plastic jars, the latter being the best value and the most convenient. This salt is produced by the old Liverpool firm of Ingram Thompson. Mention of Liverpool salt occurs quite often in 18th and 19th century cookery books, whose salt works are at Northwich. This firm's packaging is minimal, and their wholesale price is fair, so if you find you are paying too much for rock salt or crystal salt, it is probably because middlemen have bought it in bulk and are charging retailers more than is fair. Elizabeth David, English Bread and Yeast Cookery, 1977. With brine works closing or sinking all around them, the Thompsons continued in the old ways. They sent salt blocks to Cheshire schools for children to make salt carvings. At Christmas time, workers still dipped branches into brine pans to grow crystals. In the 1960s, they were still employing hand riveters to mend their lead pans and a steam engine to bring up the brine. Then in the late 1960s, Nigeria, the Thompson's principal remaining market, was destroyed by the Biafran War. Many artisans have been faced with the choice of whether to industrialize or remain a small shop. But at a certain point, that choice can be lost. If the operation becomes too unprofitable, it will no longer be able to attract the investment needed to modernize. This was the fate of the Thompsons. They hung on for more than a decade without making money. Finally, in 1986, they gave up. Cheshire is now green English countryside. The pasture land is spotted yellow and purple with wild flowers, and hedges over which blackberry vines twist. Reedy swan's paddle grows in the unused canals. It is hard to believe that 100 years ago the sky was black with coal smoke, the horizon filled with 100 smokestacks, the soil contaminated, arid, barren, and scarred white where the pan scale was dumped. Local people write to the Thompson Works and ask for the old salt, which was packed into wooden tubs and dried into salt blocks. They call it lump salt and say it is better for cooking beans and for curing meat. But there is no more Thompson salt. The Vale Royal Borough Council bought the site and established a charitable trust, which is trying to make this last of the Northwich Brine Works a restored museum. It is struggling to get funding because sinkholes surround it. Black and white cows lazily nestle into the sinkholes, which are covered with grass and shrubs and delicate white Queen Anne's lace. But every now and then, a little more subsidence is seen. Something else sinks. Many believe that one day the old Thompson Brine Works will sink too. Chapter 21. Salt and the Great Soul. 20th century India lived under the kind of colonial administration Madison and Jefferson had rejected, the kind that would have made Adams angry. And it did anger a great many Indians. To the British, the Indian economy existed for the enrichment of Great Britain. Industry was for the profit of the English Midlands. Indian salt was to be managed for the benefit of Cheshire. That the British always saw India as a commercial venture is demonstrated by the fact that when they first gained a foothold on the Asian subcontinent, they placed it in the hands of a private trading company, the Honorable East India Company. Founded in 1600 by a royal charter granted by Elizabeth I, the East India Company, though a commercial enterprise, could function as a nation, minting its own money, governing its employees as it saw fit, even raising its own army and navy, and declaring war or negotiating peace at will with other nations, providing they were not Christian. The company bought its first Indian property in 1639, a strip of coastline, and by the end of the century was building the city of Calcutta. A series of 18th century battles between the British and the French eventually secured India for the British, who turned most of it over to the British East India Company. The company established a sophisticated bureaucracy with a large, well-paid civil service. No high-ranking post was ever given to an Indian. By the 19th century, more than half of India was governed by the East India Company, and the rest by local princes, who served as puppet rulers for the British. In 1857, Indians openly revolted, and the following year, once the British army had put down the rebellion, the British Crown took over most of the local government from the East India Company. Before the British created artificial trade barriers, India had affordable, readily available salt. While it has huge saltless regions, with natural salt fields on both its coasts and huge rock salt deposits and salt lakes in between, India had an ancient tradition of salt making and trading. Although the extensive rock salt deposits in Punjab are unusually pure, strictly religious Hindus have always had a distrust of rock salt and even salt made from boiling. Indians have always preferred solar evaporated sea salt, not only for religious reasons, but because it was more accessible. On the west coast, by what is now the Pakistani border, and on the east coast near Calcutta, river estuaries spread out into wetlands and marshes where the sun evaporates seawater, leaving crusts of salt. On the west coast, in Gujarat, salt has been made for at least 5,000 years in a 9,000-square-mile marshland known as the Ran of Kutch. This marshland is covered by the sea and flooded rivers in the rainy season from August to September. In December, the salty water begins to evaporate with help from dry, wintry winds from the north. On the east coast is a salt-producing area known as Orissa, with a perfect natural sea salt zone along a tract that is 320 miles long and 10 to 60 miles deep. The salt beds, called kalaris, are flooded in two spring tides, which saturate the soil with salt as the water evaporates. Salt made from natural solar evaporation was called kartak. A second salt, panga, was produced by mixing salty soil in seawater and boiling it. The salt was a permanently renewed resource, which rendered this stretch of land not only ideal for salt making, but useless for anything else. In Orissa, the poorest of peasants could make salt on the Kalari to use or to sell. The salt makers would clear the field, the Kalari, of all vegetation, grass, and roots, to a depth of a few inches, and then pile the waste in dikes around the edges. They built sluices to let in salt water during high tide. Salt was absorbed into the earth, and then more salt water taken in with the spring tides. The additional seawater combined with the salty soil to produce concentrated brine, which they put in oblong pots, about 200 of which were cemented together by mud in a dome-shaped kiln. The salt makers placed vents at the north and south ends of each kiln so that the fire would be fanned by prevailing breezes. As the brine in the pots evaporated, workers, called malangis, added more brine, one ladle at a time, until each pot was about 3/4 full of salt crystals. The salt, which dried in piles in the open air, and which the malangis then covered with reeds, was noted for its whiteness, and was considered by many to be the best salt in India. Yet it was also inexpensive. This Panga salt had an eager market in the neighboring provinces to the west, shipped on the river Mahanadi and its tributaries. Merchants came to Orissa to buy salt or barter with products such as cotton, opium, marijuana, and grains, carried by ox cart from central India. Even the British in Bengal traded in Orissa salt. They needed large quantities of salt for the manufacture of munitions for their 18th century wars with the French, and a significant part of the salt for their gunpowder came from Orissa. Most of India, since ancient times, had a history of modest salt taxes. In Orissa, the Maratha, the ruling caste of much of pre-British India, levied a small tax on salt transported commercially in the province. The trade was so extensive that they could earn a substantial profit on this moderate tax and avoid a higher one that would damage the competitive price of Orissa salt. In return for this source of revenue, they looked after the promotion and prosperity of the salt trade. The Maratha ruler's attitude toward Orissa was reminiscent of a Chinese proverb, "Governing a state is like cooking small fish. It has to be done with a very light touch." The British practiced this light touch neither in governance nor in cooking. In the late 18th century, Cheshire was increasing its salt production and aggressively hunting overseas markets. The Empire was expected to provide these markets. Yet Liverpool salt could not compete with the price and quality of Orissa salt. In 1790, when the British requested permission to buy all the salt made in Orissa, Raghuji Bhonsla, the Maratha governor of Orissa, turned down the offer, realizing that the British were trying to eliminate Orissa salt in order to maintain British salt at an artificially high price. But when the British had their offer rejected, they simply banned Orissa salt in Bengal. Since the border that Orissa shared with Bengal was a thick jungle, difficult to patrol, the first effect of the new ban was to create well-organized bands of salt smugglers. Inexpensive contraband salt from Orissa so flooded Bengal that the British salt still could not compete there. In 1803, in the name of fighting contraband, the British army occupied Orissa and annexed it to Bengal. On November 1, 1804, by proclamation, Orissa salt became a British monopoly. The private sale of salt was completely prohibited. Those who had salt in their possession had to sell it to the government immediately at a fixed price. The transport of salt was forbidden. Even provisioning a ship with enough salt for the crew during a voyage had to be done under strict British supervision. Within 10 years, it became illegal for salt to be manufactured by anyone other than the British government. A system of well-paid informants was established to prevent clandestine salt trading. The earliest resistance in Orissa came from coastal chieftains, zemindars, whose privilege and authority were undermined by the destruction of the salt industry. Before the British, the Malangis in northern Orissa had been under control of the zemindars, who had earned a good profit selling the salt made by Malanghis for meager wages. Workers had paid a high rent to the zamindars for the use of coastal salt flats and manufactured salt on their own. Part of that rent had been providing for all of the salt needs of the zamindars' households free of charge. Still, salt workers had lived considerably better than after the British monopoly in 1804. The British advanced money to Malanghis against future salt production, and the Malanghis got deeper and deeper in debt and eventually were forced to work for the British producing salt to pay off their debt. Virtual slaves to the British Salt Department. Thousands died every year from epidemics, especially cholera. From the beginning, the zamindars had obstructed British salt policy and urged the Malanghis, whom they controlled, to be uncooperative. The Malanghis began making their own salt illegally, and hundreds were arrested. In 1817, there was a rebellion in which Malanghis attacked salt works and salt offices and chased away agents. After this uprising failed, the locals gave up on open resistance, but engaged in underground salt manufacture and trade. Some families supported themselves on illegal salt making. Back in England, it was well known that the Indians were angry with British salt policy. It was even mentioned in a cookbook. One of the greatest grievances of which the poor man can complain is the want of salt. Many of the insurrections and commotions among the Hindus have been occasioned by the cruel and unjust monopolies of certain unworthy servants of the East India Company, who, to aggrandize their own fortunes, have oftentimes bought up, on speculation, all the salt in the different ports and markets. Mary Eaton, The Cook and Housekeeper's Complete and Universal Dictionary, 1822. In the early 19th century, to make the salt tax profitable and stop the smuggling, the East India Company established customs checkpoints throughout Bengal. In 1834, a zealous commissioner of customs, G.H. Smith, was appointed, and in his 20 years in office he expanded the system into a customs line around Bengal. Salt had to pay a duty to cross the line. He was able to get taxes dropped on a series of lesser items, including tobacco, so that customs officers could concentrate on salt smuggling. Customs officers were given that always disastrous combination of broad powers and low pay. They received bounties for confiscated salt and had unchecked authority to search, seize, and arrest. Not surprisingly, bribery and other forms of corruption were widespread. In the 1840s, in its enthusiasm for enforcing this line, the East India Company constructed a 14-foot-high, 12-foot-thick thorn hedge on the western side of Bengal to prevent the entry of contraband salt. After the British government took over following the 1857 mutiny, as the uprising was labeled, the customs line grew until it snaked arbitrarily 2,500 miles across India from the Himalayas to Orissa. The hedge was expanded into a spiky gnarl of prickly pear, acacia, and more benign plants, such as bamboo. It was impenetrable, except for periodic gateways guarded by customs agents. By 1870, the customs line, largely dedicated to the enforcement of the salt tax, employed 12,000 people. At first, having complete control, the British wanted to produce Orissa salt and sell it in Bengal at their prices. They cleared jungle land in the coastal region to extend the salt-producing area. But British salt merchants became concerned about competition for sales in the Bengal market and lobbied Parliament to repress salt production in Orissa. In 1836, duties on domestic production were made equivalent to duties on imported salt. And from then on, the government did not care if salt was local or imported, because it earned the same revenue on both. The local salt, fighting its way through a cumbersome and complicated bureaucracy, could not compete. It did not sell as fast and had to be stocked in warehouses near Calcutta, and therefore risked being embezzled. The British colonial administration responded by limiting Orissa production, even closing some centers, saying that Orissa salt was of inferior quality and at a higher cost of production. In 1845, the colonial government ordered the annual production of salt to be reduced by an amount equal to half the previous year's total production. The commissioner of Orissa, A.J. M. Mills, wrote to the colonial administration, warning that reducing salt production would turn the peasants of Orissa against the British, for in the salt areas the people knew of no other economic activity. Even in the best of times, the Malangis lived hard lives in villages adjacent to salt fields. Men, women, and children, families, worked the salt fields together. Some men traveled from distant villages, leaving their families behind, and lived 5 months of the year in temporary huts near the salt works. The British charged Malangis for any salt lost during transportation, or from inadequate storage, even though transport and storage had nothing to do with salt workers. Salt agents tried to impress on the government the need to raise payments to salt makers, but instead the government, wishing to discourage production, periodically lowered the rate. The British policy was to preserve the jungles near the salt lands as sources of fuel wood. Since these forests had been reduced to clear land for salt production, they had an unusual concentration of tigers, bears, and leopards, and eventually the Malangis were so terrified of the jungle that many refused to enter to cut fuel. In the 1846 season alone, 22 Malangis were killed by tigers. The salt and the revenue departments both offered rewards for the heads of wild animals. Though the reward was considered substantial, it did not produce enough kills to significantly reduce the wildlife. In 1863, the British government announced its intention to stop local salt production and instructed salt agents to end salt manufacture as soon as possible. The abandonment of salt manufacture led to a famine in Orissa in 1866. The greatest loss of life in the famine was among the Malangis, because they had no crops of their own to fall back on for food. Government policy also caused a salt shortage in Bengal. The British responded to the crisis by starting their own plant to make Kartak salt. The object was to furnish locals with cheap salt while providing them with jobs. It was so successful that Liverpool salt could not compete, and so, in 1893, the government closed down the plant. Outperforming British salt was against the rules. Once the plant was closed down, the Malangis starved, while salt, their traditional cash crop, was lying at their feet in sparkling crusts, waiting to be picked up and sold. But even scraping salt off the surface of the flats was a severely punishable offense. The people of Orissa were forbidden from any activity connected with salt making. They left their starving wives and children and went to other parts of India looking for work, living in crowded, unsanitary conditions as they struggled to earn enough from menial labor to send some money to their families. In time, the Malangis disappeared from Orissa, and anyone there who was poor was now deprived of salt. The first public meeting in India to protest salt policy took place in Orissa in February 1888, organized by the Utkal Sabha political party in Cuttack, a river port on the river Mahanadi. It was pointed out that impoverished Indians had a tax burden 30 times greater than did people in England. The tax on salt was termed an unjust imposition of an imperial character, because the taxed salt was all imported from abroad. The government was urged to raise the income tax and save money by discontinuing the recruitment of people from abroad to the Indian civil service. These savings, the protesters at the Orissa meeting argued, would compensate the government for the loss of salt tax revenue. In the early 20th century, British salt policy was attacked in provincial legislatures throughout India. In 1923, to balance the budget, the government proposed doubling the salt tax. The Indian Legislative Assembly refused to support this proposal, but the British approved it anyway by decree from Viceroy Lord Reading. In 1927, the Legislative Assembly voted to halve the salt tax, though many had called for its complete abolition. The British government did not comply. In the Indian Legislative Assembly of 1929, Pandit Nilakanta Das, a member from Orissa, demanded the revival of salt-making in Orissa and a repeal of the salt tax. The government argued that the salt tax was the only contribution to the state that poor people ever made. The British government was not taking the issue seriously. Lord Winterland, the Undersecretary of State for India, assured the British government that there was no reason for concern about the salt issue. Not everyone in England agreed. In British Parliament, Sir Henry Craik argued that the salt tax was causing serious hardship in India, and that this hardship was leading to civil unrest. Some suggested that the revenue from the salt tax was not worth the threat that unrest posed to the British Empire. Labour members warned that the salt tax could be leading them into another Irish situation in India. In 1930, Orissa seemed near open rebellion. And so, contrary to popular belief today, it was not an entirely original idea to focus rebellion on salt, when that idea was seized upon by an entirely original man named Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi. Gandhi was born on October 2, 1869, at Porbandar, a small west coast town, capital of a princely state of the same name on the Gujarat Peninsula, not far from the Ran of Kutch. This is one of the reasons that, when he wanted to stage a salt rebellion, he chose this region and not Orissa on the opposite coast. Gandhi said that he felt closest to the salt makers of Gujarat. When he was growing up in Porbandar, Melanghis were not a part of his immediate world. He belonged to the Vaisya caste, the number three caste, below the ruling classes but above workers. Gandhi means grocer, but Mohandas's grandfather, father, and uncle had all served as prime minister to the prince of Porbandar. It was a small state, and its rulers exercised petty and arbitrary authority over the people while serving British rulers obsequiously. The humble house where Mohandas was born, still standing on the edge of town, testifies to the lack of wealth and position of a Porbandar prime minister. Mohandas's marriage, which was arranged when he was 13, lasted for the next 62 years. Despite his enduring reputation for living a life of simplicity and self-denial, he did not come to this easily and struggled in his youth with uncontrolled appetites, both sexual and gastronomic. In violation of his family's religious code, he experimented with meat-eating, hoping it would make him large and strong like the carnivorous English. Gandhi was a tiny man of peculiar passions and eccentric theories about sexual desire, diet, and bodily functions. Well into old age, he conducted experiments with young women he asked to lie naked with him through the night to test his resolve to abstain from sex. He displayed a mischievous sense of humor. It is said that when asked what he thought of Western civilization, he replied, "I think it would be a great idea." But Gandhi did not preach the superiority of Eastern culture. He said it would be folly to assume that an Indian Rockefeller would be better than an American Rockefeller. He was influenced not only by his Hindu upbringing, but by Jainism, which forbids the killing of any creature and whose priests wear masks over their mouths to ensure that they do not accidentally inhale an insect and kill it. He traveled abroad, studying law in London. Visiting Paris, he gave his impression of the new Eiffel Tower. "The tower was a good demonstration of the fact that we are all children attracted by trinkets." In South Africa, he became the leader of a movement to secure civil rights for Indians. Imprisoned for his efforts, he read Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience in the appropriate setting, a jail cell. Along with Buddhist and Jainist writings, Thoreau was to have an enormous influence on him. He was struck by Thoreau's assertion The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think right. His adversaries continually underestimated him because it seemed improbable that millions would follow such an odd man. Gandhi's approach to civil disobedience was always non-violence, but he objected to the phrase passive resistance. It was not enough to be non-violent. The adversary had to be opposed in such a way that he would not feel humiliated or defeated. He said that the opponent must be weaned from error. Seeking a name for his brand of resistance, he took a suggestion from his cousin, Maganlal Gandhi. Sadagraha, firmness in a good cause. Mohandas changed Sada to Satya, which means truth. Gandhi would resist with Satyagraha, the force of truth, a force that, he said, would lift both sides. In all he did, Gandhi displayed an inner confidence. He was certain that his cause was right, and because it was right, it would prevail. His quiet self-assurance made him a man of constant surprises, making sudden decisions and steering unexpected courses of action. When World War I broke out, this pacifist who fought British colonialism announced his support for the British war effort, thereby completely confusing his followers. Just when he appeared to be denouncing the Industrial Revolution and its machinery, he suddenly confessed his affection for Singer sewing machines. It is one of the few useful things ever invented, and there is a romance about the device itself. Louis Fisher, his biographer who knew him personally, wrote, "A conversation with him was a voyage of discovery. He dared to go anywhere without a chart." The other most famous Indian of his day, Nobel Prize-winning novelist Rabindranath Tagore, a tall and eloquent aristocrat, is credited with giving Gandhi his famous title, Mahatma, the great soul, or as he put it, the great soul in beggar's garb. In 1885, the Indian National Congress was founded in Bombay by mostly high-caste intellectuals, including even a few Englishmen. Originally, some were even in favor of continuing British rule, but gradually they became the leading force in the independence movement. It was Gandhi who made the Indian National Congress and the cause of Indian independence a mass movement. One of the primary tools in accomplishing this metamorphosis was the Salt Satyagraha, the Salt Campaign. The idea of a Salt Satyagraha had its beginnings in the 1929 Indian National Congress session in Lahore. While salt had become a burning issue in a few regions, it was not at the time a national issue. And despite a smoldering rebellion in Orissa and a few other places, most of Gandhi's colleagues were barely aware of it. Many in the Congress, even those closest to Gandhi, were baffled by his idea of focusing the independence movement on salt. But Gandhi argued that it was an example of British misrule that touched the lives of all castes of Indians. Everyone ate salt, he argued. Everyone, in fact, except Gandhi himself, who had renounced the eating of salt and, at the time, had not touched it in 6 years. On March 2, 1930, Gandhi wrote to Lord Irwin, Viceroy of India, "If you cannot see your way to deal with these evils and my letter makes no appeal to your heart, then on the 12th day of this month I shall proceed with such co-workers of the ashram as I can take to disregard the provisions of the salt laws. I regard this tax to be the most iniquitous of all from the poor man's standpoint. As the independence movement is essentially for the poorest in the land, the beginning will be made with this evil. The wonder is that we have submitted to the cruel monopoly for so long." The viceroy expressed his regret at Gandhi's decision to break the law. The ashram to which Gandhi referred was in Gujarat, across the Sabarmati River from the city of Ahmedabad. It was an ashram for satyagrahis, people committed to the force of truth, and Gandhi had pointed out to his followers, when they settled there, that they were conveniently located close to the Ahmedabad jail, where they would be spending much of their time. The prophecy was accurate. Jainism was popular in the area, which meant it became a refuge for the pests others exterminated, but Jainists would not harm. It was swarming with snakes. Gandhi lived on the ashram in a small room the size of a prison cell. In fact, prison cells were a small adjustment in Gandhi's way of life. He even commented that he could get more reading done in prison. On March 12, 1930, Gandhi and 78 selected followers left the ashram with the intention of walking 240 miles to the sea at Dundee, where they would defy British law by scraping up salt. A few were not from the ashram, including two Muslims and a Christian, and two men from the lowest, untouchable caste. Gandhi intended the group to be a cross-section of India, but he refused to allow women marchers out of what he termed a delicate sense of chivalry. He explained, "We want to go in for suffering, and there may be torture. If we put the women in front, the government may hesitate to inflict on us all the penalty that they might otherwise inflict." They walked slowly along the dusty road, 12 miles a day, with the horizon rippling with heat. Marching in the lead with a bamboo walking stick was the bony 60-year-old Gandhi, his slow steps full of self-assurance and determination. Some grew too tired, or their feet became too sore, and they retreated to carts. A horse was kept nearby for Gandhi, but he never used it. The march began each day at 6:30 a.m. By then, Gandhi had been up for hours, spinning cloth, writing articles or speeches. He was seen writing letters by moonlight in the middle of the night. He stopped to speak to the villagers who gathered eagerly to see the Mahatma, and he invited them to join him and to break the British salt monopoly. He also preached better sanitation and urged them to abstain from drugs and alcohol, to treat the untouchables as brothers, and to wear khadar, the homespun cloth of India, rather than imported British textiles. In the 1760s, before the American Revolution, John Adams also had urged Americans to wear homespun instead of British imports. "For me there is no turning back, whether I am alone or joined by thousands," Gandhi wrote. But he was not alone. Along the way, local officials showed support by resigning their government posts. The Anglo-Indian press ridiculed him. The Statesman of Calcutta said that he could go on boiling seawater indefinitely till dominion status was achieved. But the foreign news media was fascinated by this little man marching against the entire British Empire, and people all over the world cheered his improbable defiance. The press reported on his power to persuade, his determination. But the Viceroy, Lord Irwin, who was being informed by British agents, was convinced that Gandhi would soon collapse. He even wrote the Secretary of State for India that Gandhi's health was poor, and that if he continued his daily march, he would die, and it will be a very happy solution. On April 5th, after 25 days of marching, Gandhi reached the sea at Dundee, not with his 78 followers behind him, but with thousands. Among them were elite intellectuals and the desperately poor, and many women, including affluent women from the cities. Through the night, Gandhi led his followers in prayer by the warm, lapping waves of the Arabian Sea. At first light, he led a few into the water for a ceremony of purification. Then he waded out and felt his way up the beach with his spindly legs to a point where a thick crust of salt, evaporated by the sun, was cracking. He bent down and picked up a chunk of the crust, and in so doing, broke the British salt law. "Hail, Deliverer!" a pilgrim shouted. On the other side of India, the people of Orissa decided to begin salt-making even before Gandhi arrived in Dundee, and they resolved to continue whether the rest of the country followed Gandhi's example or not. They opened a camp at Cuttack, to which volunteers from different parts of Orissa came and signed oaths vowing to dedicate themselves to resisting the salt laws. Regular meetings were held to discuss the nature and importance of the salt satyagraha. The British banned such meetings, and people giving public addresses on the subject were arrested and imprisoned. A public salt making was organized in Orissa on April 6th to coincide with Gandhi's. Locals blew conch shells and tossed flower petals to announce their day of nonviolent civil disobedience. As they traveled along the coasts, their leader, Gopabandhu Chaudhary, was arrested, but the group continued. On April 13th, at 8:30 a.m., they reached their destination, Inchuri, where thousands turned out to watch them break the law. They leaned over and scooped up handfuls of salt. The police tried to forcibly remove the salt from their hands. A crowd of dissidents ran onto the beach, picked up salt, and were taken away by the police. The protests went on for days, with waves of salt makers followed by waves of police, followed by more salt makers. The police called in reinforcements. Soon the jails were filled, and more police and protesters were rushing into Inchuri. The police staged charges, harmless but designed to scare. It didn't work. The salt protests spread along the coastline. A large number of the dissidents were women. Some of the salt-making demonstrations were even organized by women. The police used clubs, but the protesters remained nonviolent. After the demonstrations were over, 20,000 people turned out to throw flowers and cheer the released satyagrahis returning home from prison. It took only a week for Gandhi's ceremonious moment on Dandi Beach to become a national movement. Salt making, really salt gathering, was widespread. In keeping with Gandhi's other teachings, protesters were picketing liquor stores and burning foreign cloth. Salt was openly sold on the streets, and the police responded with violent roundups. In Karachi, the police shot and killed two young Congress activists. In Bombay, hundreds were tied with rope and dragged off to prison after the police discovered that salt was being made on the roof of the Congress headquarters. Teachers, students, peasants, it seemed most of India was making salt. Western newspapers covered the campaign, and the world seemed to sympathize, not with the British, but with the salt campaigners. White Gandhi hats became fashionable in America, while the Mahatma remained bareheaded. But the protest movement had spread to other groups that did not use the force of truth. One such group raided an East Bengal arsenal and killed six guards. When armored cars were sent against demonstrators in Peshawar, in the northwest, one armored car was attacked and set on fire. A second car opened fire with machine guns and killed 70 people. Gandhi sent a letter to Lord Irwin protesting police violence, which began, as always, "Dear friend." He then announced that he was going to march to the government-owned salt works and take them over in the name of the people. British troops went to the village near Dandi, where the leader was sleeping under a tree, and arrested him. The Manchester Guardian warned the British government that the arrest of Gandhi was a costly misstep, further provoking India. The Herald, the official organ of the Labour Party, also opposed the arrest of Gandhi. While India exploded, Gandhi sat in prison, spinning cotton. As many as 100,000 protesters, including all of the major leaders and most of the minor local ones, were in prison. Congress committees were declared illegal. Still, the salt movement went on. The government tried to negotiate with the jailed leaders. Disapprovingly, Winston Churchill said the government of India had imprisoned Gandhi, and they had been sitting outside his cell door, begging him to help them out of their difficulties. On March 5th, 1931, Lord Irwin signed the Gandhi-Irwin Pact, ending the salt campaign. Indians living on the coast were to be permitted to collect salt for their own use only. political prisoners were released. A round-table conference was scheduled in London to discuss British administration in India. And all civil disobedience was to be stopped. It was considered a compromise. To some, the British had won on most points, but Gandhi was pleased because he thought that for the first time England and India were talking as equal partners rather than master and subject. Irwin suggested they drink a tea to seal the pact, and Gandhi said his tea would be water, lemon, and a pinch of salt. Gandhi had emerged as the leading voice of Indian aspirations, and the Indian National Congress had become the primary organization of the independence movement. In 1947, India became independent, and 5 months later, Gandhi was assassinated by a fellow Hindu who mistakenly interpreted his efforts to make peace with Muslims as part of a plan to favor them. Jawaharlal Nehru, the son of a patrician lawyer who helped found the Indian National Congress, became prime minister. Nehru was once asked how he remembered Gandhi, and he said he always thought of him as the figure with a walking stick, leading the crowd onto the beach at Dundee. In 300 BC, long before the British arrived, a book titled Arthashastra recorded that under India's first great empire, founded by Chandragupta Maurya, salt manufacture was supervised by a state official called a Lavanyadyaksa, under a system of licenses granted for fixed fees. More than a half century after the British left, salt production was still supervised by the government. After 1947, independent India was committed to making salt available at an affordable price. Salt production in independent India was organized into small cooperatives, most of which failed. The industry is now controlled by a few powerful salt traders. The government is supposed to look after the interests of the salt workers through the Salt Commissionerate. Across the river from Gandhi's ashram in Ahmedabad, Gujarat's Salt Commissionerate stands accused by many workers of looking after the traders rather than the workers. The rock salt of Punjab is now in Pakistan. The west coasts, Gujarat and the Ran of Kutch, has become India's major salt producer, whereas Orissa, with only 6 salt works surviving into contemporary times, is no longer an important salt-producing region. Almost 3/4 of India's salt is now produced in Gujarat. Gujaratis, with their coastal economy, are not among India's poorest population. But the wages in the salt works are so low that most salt workers come from more impoverished regions. Every year, in September, thousands of migrant workers arrive in Gujarat to work 7-day weeks until the salt season ends in the spring. They often earn little more than $1 a day. Hundreds of workers are undeclared so that the salt traders can avoid paying them social benefits and circumvent laws forbidding child labor. Many of the workers are from the lowest caste and are hopelessly in debt to the salt producers. The glare of the salt in the dry season sunlight renders many of the salt workers permanently colorblind. And they complain that when they die, their bodies cannot be properly cremated because they are impregnated with salt. A storm that hit Gujarat in June 1998 decimated this cheap labor force, killing between 1,000 and 14,000 people, depending on whose count is believed. The price of Indian salt soared. But by the end of the year, the workforce had been replaced and the price had dropped back. Once again, salt could be purchased at a low, affordable price, which every Indian citizen has a right to expect. Chapter 22. Not Looking Back. Some 3,000 years ago, wanting a capital in the commanding heights of the Judean hills, David conquered the fortress of Zion and built Jerusalem. Those heights have at times been a fortified high ground and at other times a peaceful, gardened promenade. They offer, depending on the times, either a scenic or a strategic view of the region. Not only can a great deal of Israel be seen from here, but on a clear day, the Moab Mountains of Jordan are in view as a distant, pinkish cloud. But what cannot be seen, because it is lower than the horizon. In fact, it is the lowest point on earth, 1,200 feet below sea level, is a vanishing natural wonder, the Dead Sea. The Hebrews call the sea Yam Hamalah, the Salt Sea. About 45 miles long and 11 miles at its widest, the Dead Sea, with the Israeli-Jordanian border running through the center of it, seems a peaceful place, of a stark and barren beauty. A first impression might be that the area is uninhabitable, and yet, like many of the world's uninhabitable corners, it has been converted, with a great deal of water and electricity, into a fast-growing and profitable resort. The minerals in the Dead Sea give a strange buoyancy that entices tourists for brief dips. The sea is oily on the skin and doesn't feel like water. This is brine that will float more than an egg. After wading in a few feet, a human body pops to the surface, almost above the water, as though lying on an air-filled float. It is a most comfortable mattress, perfectly conforming to every part of the back, what a waterbed was supposed to be. The water, if it is water, is clear, but every swirl is visible in its syrupy density. The minerals can be felt working into the skin, and it feels as though some metamorphosis is taking place. The bather is marinating. Pliny wrote, "The bodies of animals do not sink in it. Even bulls and camels float, and from this arises the report that nothing sinks." Edward Robinson, an American professor of biblical literature, reported after his 1838 trip, with no more hyperbole than Pliny, that he could sit, stand, lie, or swim in the water without difficulty. Jericho, an oasis a few miles north of the Dead Sea near the Jordan River, which flows to the Dead Sea, is thought to be the oldest town in the world. Almost 10,000 years ago, Jericho was a center for the salt trade. In 1884, in the nearby Moab Mountains of Jordan, the Greek Orthodox Church decided to build a church at the site of a Byzantine ruin in the town of Madaba. Workers uncovered a 6th-century mosaic floor map, still on display on the floor of the Church of St. George, showing the Dead Sea with two ships carrying salt, heading toward Jericho. But the sea may have been better for transporting salt than producing it. The oily water of the Dead Sea is bitter, as though it were cursed. The area is famous for curses, the most well-known being the one that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. The exact locations of Sodom and Gomorrah are unknown, but its residents are thought to have been salt workers, and the towns are believed to have been located in the southern Dead Sea region. Since Genesis states that God annihilated all vegetation at the once fertile spot, this barren, rocky area fits the description. But this area also has a mountain, more like a long, jagged ridge, called Mount Sodom, of almost pure salt carved by the elements into Gothic pinnacles. According to the book of Genesis, Abraham's nephew Lot lived in Sodom and was spared when God destroyed the town. But Lot's wife, who looked back at the destruction, was turned into salt. As columns break away from Mount Sodom, they are identified for tourists as Lot's wife. Unfortunately, they are unstable formations. The last Lot's wife collapsed several years ago, and the current one, featured in postcards and on guided tours, will go very soon, according to geologists. In biblical times, Mount Sodom was the most valuable Dead Sea property. It was long controlled by the king of Arad, who had refused entry to Moses and his wandering Hebrews from Egypt. One of the most important trade routes in the area was from Mount Sodom to the Mediterranean.